Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Ed Haig. He's a writer and former teacher. He's now living in Greensboro. He lived in Taiwan for almost 6 years, married a woman he met there. He's fluent in Mandarin. And while he was there, he developed an interest in Charlie Soong, somebody I've been interested in for a long time. Charlie Soong, for those of you can't remember him or never heard of him, he was the father of Madam Chiang Kai-shek and several other important Chinese people. Madam Chiang, for my generation, was a very prominent person who represented her husband, who was the leader of China during World War II. Well, Charlie Soong has a lot of North Carolina connections, and Ed, in your new book, Charlie Soong, North Carolina's Link to the Fall of the Last Emperor of China, you tell us about some of Chinese history and some of North Carolina's history that we didn't know about. How did you get interested in Charlie Soong?
Well, it started, first of all, thank you for having me on your show, DG. I really appreciate it. It started in 1996, after I finished college, and I always wanted to visit China or some country of Chinese, had a Chinese relationship. And I ended up moving to Taiwan in 96. And eventually, after moving around several times, I eventually moved in Taipei, very close to Madam Song Meiling's house in what's called the Shiling district of Taipei. And I first kind of became aware of Charlie Soong's story at that time while I was living in Taiwan. I read a book at that time by Sterling Seagrave, the Song Dynasty, and I read that, and I read it, it's interesting. And then as the years passed, I kind of forgot about it. Well, eventually I moved back to the States. I married a girl from Taiwan, and I moved back to the States and eventually ended up in North Carolina. Well, I'm reading a newspaper one day, and the Song name pops up again. I know that name from somewhere, and I go, oh yeah, that is the father of Song Meiling, who I believe spent some time in North Carolina. So the more I looked into it, the more I investigated and looked around Durham and down in Trinity and down in Wilmington and a few trips. I did some minor investigating and got more and more interested in the story. And as I researched, I found out, I wonder if there's enough for another book here, because a lot of time has passed and there was significantly more documents that came out since the 1980s about Charlie Soong in his story. So this is a Soong name has kind of followed me from, as I moved to Taiwan, it followed me to North Carolina. And at one point I figured, you know, I've always wanted to learn more about this topic, so I decided to follow through with a book on that, and it turned out indeed there was enough.
Well, it's for me I've loved reading the book. I've been interested, like you, in Charlie Soong, but never had his story put together quite the same way. So how about, I don't want you to give an elevator speech, but can you give a brief for people who've never heard of Charlie Soong and his North Carolina experience? Can you summarize it for us? How did he get to North?
Yeah.
How did a Chinese young man get to North Carolina in the time not that far after the Civil War?
Yeah. So he was born in 1861, and he was born on an island called Hainan, which is an island off the southern coast of China. As a teenager, he eventually came to work for an uncle in Boston, in the Boston area. He, for various reasons, that some of which may be lost to history, he did not like working in the shops in Chinatown, in his uncle's shop there. So he ended up working for what was called the forerunner to the Coast Guard in Boston. After that, he ended up in Wilmington after a transfer of his supervisor down to Wilmington. He followed his supervisor, who was a captain, Captain Gabrielson, down to Wilmington, and ended up working for him again, for the Coast Guard. But when he was in Wilmington, he got more and more interested in the Methodist Church in Wilmington, and basically ended up being adopted at the age of, if you can call it adoption, at the age of 18 or 19, by some locals in Wilmington, mostly by the Reverend there at the Fifth Avenue Methodist Church, called Reverend Rick Hodd. Some folks in Durham took an interest in him and decided that a college education would do him well. So they brought him up to Durham and eventually to Trinity College, where he was trained as a missionary. And after
one of those Durham people is someone or was someone who's familiar to many people in the Chapel Hill Carver area.
Yes, his most important benefactor was Julian Carr, whom he developed a relationship with he first met around 1880, and Julian Carr basically decided to informally kind of adopt him and pay for his tuition and his upkeep for the next year or two while he was in Durham. And that would eventually develop into a lifelong relationship as Charlie moved through Trinity College and then was eventually transferred to Vanderbilt University in Nashville.
How was this Chinese boy who was uneducated in terms of at least American standards, how was he able to go to college and survive at Trinity or at Vanderbilt?
Yeah, it's very interesting because when he got to Wilmington, he spoke very limited English, which would have been very broken English, I'm sure, at the time. So when it was decided to kind of take him on as a student, his benefactors knew of the challenges, and English would be one of those challenges. So at the time he was at Trinity College in Trinity, North Carolina, his main goal basically was to improve his English at that time. So he spent much time and much effort in that year, although he was enrolled in formal subjects. It was really English that was his main focus of study. And as he progressed over his time and then on to Vanderbilt, his English really got better and better, and that allowed him to expand into other areas and improve his profession, which would have been missionary.
Why were these people wanting to give this young Chinese guy an education? What was their motive for doing this, other than just being nice guys?
Yeah, a couple of reasons. Charlie seemed to have be very charismatic, although he was somewhat limited in his language and his communication abilities because of his lack of English. By all accounts, he was a very charismatic person, and he was very well liked by nearly everybody that met him. Another factor that played into that was the missionary work, especially more with the Protestant branches of Christianity in the States. China was really becoming a focus of missionary work at that time in the 18s, really going back to the 1850s. Even maybe a little bit before that. So as China became more and more of a focus of missionary work, more and more Americans were being sent over to China as missionaries. Well, here comes North Carolina in the 1880s, maybe a handful of Chinese in the whole state at this time. Here comes this Chinese person to North Carolina, and I think it dawned upon some of the people in the church at the time and say, well, here's this newcomer to our state. We really like him. He is from China. Maybe he's got a very much an interest in missionary work and in Christianity. And I wonder if we trained him as a missionary, if he would be willing to go back to China and be one of our
missionaries. Was Charlie Soong a Christian?
He converted to Christianity in Wilmington in the last part of 1880. So prior to his coming into America, no, he was not a Christian. It seems like the earliest influence, as far as his Christian beliefs, would have been the captain of his boat, the Gallatin. The name of the boat was the SS Gallatin, up in Boston. And the name of that captain was Gabrielson, Captain Gabrielson, who really took a liking to Charlie, and he was a pretty devout Methodist. So it seems like that was his first exposure to Methodism. And then as Captain Gabrielson got transferred down to Wilmington, Charlie followed, and the influence followed after that. And it seems, it's hard to prove, but it seems like that Captain Gabrielson was fairly influential in introducing him to the Methodists.
So the idea was with among the Methodists, oh gosh, we're sending American missionaries to China, and now we've got a Chinese guy who's converted to Christianity, so let's educate him and send him back to be a missionary? Was that the idea?
Right. Yeah. They figured, and he would already have one of the big difficulties with missionaries was the language skills when they got to their new country.
Well, I want to tell you what we need to take a break, and I want to after the break, I want Ed, who's written a wonderful new book about Charlie Soong, North Carolina's link to the fall of the last emperor of China, to talk about what happened to this young man once he was sent back to China to serve in the Methodist mission field. Ed Hagen, I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and if you join us late, I'm visiting with Ed Hague from Greensboro, who is the author of a recent biography about Charlie Soong, called Charlie Soong, North Carolina's Link to the Fall of the Last Emperor. If you joined us late, Ed has been telling us a little bit about how this young Chinese boy made his way to North Carolina in about 1880, and how Julian Carr in Durham and other Methodists took an interest in him, saw to his education over at Trinity College, before it moved to Durham. It was over in Randolph County, and then to Vanderbilt, where he perfected his English, got theological training, and became, a minister of sorts, and was sent back to China. Ed, as you were saying right before the break, in part because, heck, this would be great. We've got a devout Christian, a Chinese person who can go and speak the language and preach to the Chinese. But there was a problem with that, wasn't there?
Yes, a very unanticipated problem. Charlie was installed into missionary or work in Charlotte in 1885. That was when the ordination was as official ministry. And he was sent over to China, yes, eventually. And when he got to China, well, here are all these high expectations of a devout Chinese Christian going over to China and being able to communicate directly with the people. Well, things didn't work out as planned because if people know much about China, there are a lot of different dialects. China is a very big country, and there are a lot of different dialects in China. And most of those dialects are mutually unintelligible to each other. So when Charlie got to Shanghai, he found out that the dialect spoken in Shanghai was vastly different from the dialect spoken in Hainan province, which was his home in China, where he was from. So the communication thing kind of withered up.
So he was no better equipped to go out and preach to the people in and around Shanghai than an English speaking American would be.
That is absolutely correct, and he writes of that a few times in some of his letters. And interestingly, D.G., not only with the communication, with his language, but he had spent, by the time he got to Shanghai, he had spent 5 years in America, and most of those in North Carolina and Tennessee. He was very well acclimated to America in American ways. When he got to China, it was at least as big of a culture shock for him to move to Shanghai as it was for him when he originally moved to America. And he writes of this in a few notes or a few letters back to the Christian Advocate in Raleigh and a few letters to his friends in Durham and in Raleigh. He writes how difficult it is for him to adapt and how he feels like a stranger in a strange land. He just says these things over and over again. So it wasn't just the language that he had to kind of learn. It was he had to learn the culture all over again. So, in fact, for the remainder of his life, he kind of felt as a wherever he was, kind of a stranger, a little bit at home, but a little bit of a stranger, no matter which country he was.
What
as anybody who's lived overseas would feel
with this handicap? How did he work out as a member of the team of Methodist missionaries in Shanghai, most of whom were American, although they were, I guess, educating Chinese youth and other converts. But how did that go for Charlie as a part of the missionary movement, where General Carr and the other devout Methodists here in North Carolina had envisioned that he would go back and help save the souls of Chinese people?
Yeah, that's the point of some debate in the letters and some of the communications that have survived from that time. Because the year before he was sent over, there was talk in some letters about him being sent over to Shanghai as sort of an academic to work in a university, maybe translating and doing things of that nature. But then, as it turned out, by the time he got over there, they wanted him, his superiors decided that he would be better off doing what was called circuit work, which means just basically doing the hardcore missionary, going out on the front lines of the missionary field, and most not insignificantly for not a lot of money. The pay would be very low for somebody in that position. And because he was Chinese, he was not paid the same as an American missionary coming over to China. So he was really not treated very well in his first few years when he came over there, even compared to, some of the American missionaries that would have went over there for a year or two.
Did he cheerfully
kind of treated as a second life?
Did he cheerfully accept this discrimination?
Many, many times in many letters, and it finally culminates in one letter back to his friends, one of his friends in Durham, basically saying, I don't know how much longer of this I can take. Eventually I want to get married and, have a family and have children, and there's no way I can survive on these wages. And he goes on to say that I think I could serve my country and I think I could serve, the church in other ways, and I'm seriously considering.
How you tell this story better than anyone else, at least as far as I'm concerned, about how Charlie Soong eased out of the working for pay for the church and became a businessman, but selling and then printing Bibles. Can you tell that story about what happened?
Yeah, he was working as a missionary, and he had his English skills down by this point. And of course, his other experience was in the Christian church, and working for the Methodists. So eventually, he would get a job working for, as he still did missionary work, he kind of took on a part-time job working for the American Bible Society, whose mission it was to spread Christianity and help distribute Bibles to parts of the world that may not have had them yet. So he kind of took this on as a part-time job, but as he got into it, he discovered that printing the Bibles would also possibly be a way to make some additional money. And as fate would have it, China was kind of undergoing an educational revolution at this time, in the centuries prior, reading and writing Chinese was something that was only done by kind of the highest levels of society. If you were, say, a regular Joe and you wanted to learn to read and write Chinese, it really wasn't going to happen. There was only one style of Chinese, and it was called classical Chinese. and that was the style that was really for reserved for the upper educated classes. By the time the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s come around, there was a real push in China by educational reformers to change the language into something that could be learned and used by everyday people in China. So in the centuries prior, if there was a Bible in Chinese, it would be printed in what would be called classical Chinese, which is very difficult even for most Chinese today to read. But after this revolution, when everyday Chinese becomes more and more popular, there became more and more of a demand for books, and in after books, it became the Bibles as well.
So so many things about what you're saying interest me, and one is this notion about classical Chinese being, as I think you said, like Latin was in the Middle Ages. It was the language of the cultured people, but it froze out any participation from the hoi polloi. The other is printing in Chinese, and you think about the tough enough in those days to lay out a page with English script where you got 20 or 30 or 40 characters and symbols that you can put on the printing press, but with Chinese having thousands of different characters, a printing would be kind of complicated. I could never figure out how you would handle a printing press in China, but Charlie Soong mastered it, I guess.
Yes, it sounds like a very labor-intensive process, doesn't it?
It really does, and you'd have to have a storehouse of a storehouse of thousands of characters, I guess, to lay out
correct.
A page.
Yeah, and you make a good point with the printing press. Printing was just kind of making its way on a large scale to China at this time. One of the first Chinese newspapers was just really printed in Hong Kong. I believe it was called the Universal Circulating Herald by one of Charlie's kind of forerunners named Wang Tao. And that was basically one of the first Chinese newspapers printed for the public in the history of China. So all these things are kind of new at this time, even 1870s, 1880s, 1890s.
Did Charlie get rich as a printer? Is that where his wealth came? I tell you what, I've gone over time again.
Okay.
Ed Haig, we're talking about your book, the new book about Charlie Soong, subtitled North Carolina's Link to the Fall of the Last Emperor. This is D.G. Martin. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about where Charlie Soong's wealth came from and what he did with that money that he made. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Ed Haig from Greensboro. He is the author of a new book about one of my favorite North Carolina characters, Charlie Soong. The book is called Charlie Soong, North Carolina's Link to the Fall of the Last Emperor of China. Ed, this is fascinating to me. You've got this poor, almost orphan, dislocated Chinese boy who wound up in Wilmington. Durham people, including Julian Carr, provided for his education and sent him back to China to be a part of the Methodist mission field. And as you described, he chafed under the leadership of the American Methodist and eased out. They didn't pay him enough to raise his family. And he got into the Bible business, the Bible printing business. How did that lead to the making of, or what happened after that?
Yeah, there's been a lot of speculation over the ensuing decades about how Charlie really made his money. There was conjecture that he originally got money from Julian Carr to start his printing business. There's not a lot of proof of that. But they're even more to the point, it's not likely that Charlie made most of his wealth in the printing business. He might have made some. But he would also go on to work as what was called a comprador at that time in Shanghai. And what a comprador was someone a Chinese person who had experience both in America and China, and they would work as sort of a kind of a middleman between any Chinese companies wanting to do business in America or even Europe and between China. They were kind of very valuable at that time, and they would be very well compensated because they knew, in the age before the internet, they knew how things worked in America and in China. So to a Chinese company, somebody like that would be very valuable, especially if they had some business experience.
Yeah, we're familiar with that that concept, or at least I am. It's sort of a fixer concept, and it's all in the news as we read about these Americans who were involved with Europeans, including Russians, in terms of helping each side adjust to the different culture and language of the others. They sort of knew how business was conducted in other places and were bridge builders, I guess. And that is that sort of what Charlie Soong was doing? This is a new concept to me about how Charlie got rich.
Yes, that is right along the lines of what I'm discussing when I talk about this work as a comprador. The specific job he had was a flour mill, and the name of the flour mill, I believe, was the Fofeng Flour Mill in Shanghai. So he worked as kind of in this comprador capacity at this flour mill as basically a go-between between what would have been American businesses and flour mill in Shanghai. So if you could had to guess where he made more of his money, it would probably be somewhere along those lines at the flour mill.
Along this, at this point, he's beginning to build a family. Can you tell us a little bit about Charlie Soong's family and how that family became even more prominent, maybe, than Charlie?
Yeah, as he got more into business and he was able to support a family, he indeed started to have children beginning in the 1890s, and that would be in Shanghai as well. And at a younger age, the children would be educated in Shanghai, but as they got older, Charlie, for various reasons, all of which we may never know, decided to send his kids off to America for their education. But one of the main considerations that I think has been kind of lost to history, that as Charlie got more and more involved in revolutionary underground activities, if he was ever caught by the authorities in China, he and his family would be in a lot of trouble. So what I believe he may have been thinking by sending his kids off to America was kind of putting them in sort of a safer place while he continued in his activities in Shanghai.
I want to take another break, and when we come back, I want to talk on when you, Ed Haig, the author of the new book about Charlie Soong, North Carolina's link to the last emperor of China, to talk about the children of Charlie Soong, including whom we came to know as Madam Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Sun Yat-sen. These were young women whose father got their start in North Carolina. Ed Haig and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Ed Haig from Greensboro. He is the author of a recent book about one of my favorite North Carolina characters, Charlie Soong. It's called Charlie Soong, North Carolina's Link to the Fall of the Last Emperor of China. Ed, during the break, you mentioned that we talked a little bit about Charlie Soong's time in North Carolina. You mentioned that there are a couple of other things we should cover, and let's do that now.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, while Charlie was in North Carolina in the early 1880s, it was quite a remarkable experience at that time, in that in the rest of the country, and especially along the West Coast, discrimination against the Chinese was really on the upswing against any Chinese in America at the time. We have things, there's anti-Chinese riots in various states on the West Coast. There's a mining act that's passed in the 1850s in California that really excludes any Chinese from participating in gold mining. And then there's also Chinese being sent to various countries like Cuba and in South America to work very labor-intensive jobs bordering almost on slavery. At that time, to be basically adopted and sent to school as a Chinese during the time of the 1880s was really a remarkable thing. And all this discrimination eventually culminates in the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which really barred Chinese from even entering America for several decades. This is when Charlie's kind of at his peak here in North Carolina and in Tennessee, so it's very interesting to note that contrast while his many Chinese were being so treated so badly. North Carolina and Tennessee really, really were the exception in treating Charlie so well the way that they did.
Well, moving back to Charlie's family and the reason, I guess, that Charlie Soong is as famous as he is not because he's of his success as a business person in China or even his participation in the revolutionary activities of Sun Yat-sen as the dynasty, the emperor in the dynasty of China was overthrown and republic established. Charlie Soong was in the middle of all that, as you describe so well in your book. But tell us about the daughters and maybe even some of the other children. What happened to them?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
There's a famous quote that all Chinese kids learned in school about the three daughters of Charlie Soong, and I may be a little bit off here, but it's called, the saying was, one loved power, one loved money, and one loved China. The three daughters of Charlie Soong would really go on to be more famous than Charlie. The first, or not the first in order of birth, but kind of the first in popularity in America would be Song Meiling, who was also known to many Americans as Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who married Chiang Kai-shek in the, I believe it was the 1920s. And as the revolution became more and more entrenched in China, eventually ended up on the island of Taiwan. She became kind of a darling in America at the time because she spoke to Congress in the years around World War II as China was trying to get more and more support for their war against Japan. And people heard her recordings and saw photos of her and speaking in front of Congress, United States Congress, and they wondered, who's this Chinese woman who speaks perfect English, kind of with a little bit of a Southern accent? Where did she come from? How is this possible? So she kind of became one of the more famous daughters of Charlie. And then, of course, in terms of fame, Song Qingling was her sister, and she became famous as Sun Yat-sen's wife, Sun Yat-sen, the founder of the Republic of China.
Well, we might have a minute or two for you to describe Charlie Soong's relationship with the political events that were taking place in China. He was an established businessman with links to the ruling dynasty of China. Did he get involved in the revolutionary activities of Sun Yat-sen?
Yeah, as he moved back to Shanghai and he stayed there, the longer he stayed, the more he kind of became upset with what he called the backwardness of China and their kind of continued entrenchment in tradition and not looking forward. So, and he wasn't the only one thinking this. He met up in the early years with a man named Sun Yat-sen, who any fan of Chinese history would know as kind of the president of modern China or the president of the Republic of China. Both of these men, as they talked, they would really preach for more revolutionary change in China. But of course, the emperor was still in charge of things in China at that time. And as Charlie and Sun Yat-sen kind of became the de facto leader of the revolution that would eventually overthrow the last emperor of China. And Charlie Song would become very influential in Sun Yat-sen's life, and especially in terms of acquiring money and support for the revolution. But because he had a family in Shanghai and he could not really go anywhere, he did everything really on low key and very clandestinely. That doesn't make a easy job for a historian because he covered his tracks very well. But as the years passed, more and more things are found out about his real contribution to the revolution that eventually overthrew the last emperor of China.
Ed Haig, there's so much more to talk about your book and the story you tell, not just about Charlie Soong or Madam Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Sun Yat-sen and all of these personalities important on the world stage who had their origins, we would argue, right here in North Carolina. But I'd like for you to talk a little bit about how you wrote this book. And let me frame the question this way. The so-called...
I'm having a hard time. I'm having a hard time hearing you.
I apologize. I want to talk about how you wrote the book and why you wrote it, just real quickly, because we don't have a lot of time. But until I read your book, the place I would turn to learn about Charlie Soong was a book called The Soong Dynasty. You mentioned it earlier. This guy, it was written maybe 30 years ago by Sterling Seagrave, and you mentioned him in your list of books that people who get interested in Charlie Soong might read, but I couldn't find a single. You didn't rely on him at all, did you? Was it deliberate? Did you feel like that his story needed to be cleaned up and rewritten, or what was your strategy about not going to the Soong Dynasty book as a source for your book?
Yeah, I really enjoyed, I think Sterling Seagrave is a wonderful writer, and I really enjoyed a few of his books. But I really wanted to go back to the primary sources, mm-hmm. if I could. So anything that was mentioned anywhere, I would go back. They would usually be in Duke or in Wilmington as far as primary sources would go. So I go back to the primary and try to confirm. If I read something somewhere, I would try to confirm it with a primary source. And if I couldn't confirm it, I just wouldn't use it as a primary. I wouldn't use it at all, really, in the book. So I really kind of used that method.
So you're not taking a pot shot at the Soong Dynasty. You're just doing your own thing. Is that?
Yeah. Mr. Seagrave's a great writer. He kind of has his own style, and I have my kind of own style. So I just kind of, and I wanted to approach things from a little different angle and a little more updated, if you would, with the resources that I had. And I was kind of right here, you know, while I was in Greensboro, I was right here in the middle of it all, being so close to Durham, Wilmington.
It seemed to be a rich source of your research was in the letters that are housed in the Charlie Soong papers over at the Duke Library. And was
right,
it
in
fun?
The Rubenstein archives, yeah, over at the Duke Library. And I was really, as I kind of did some preliminary research, I didn't know what I was going to find. But as I proceeded, I really found out there was a lot of new materials in there in the past 20 or 30 years. And the other thing I did, I spent a lot of time, I combed through just about every publication that Charlie had ever been printed in, and I ended up finding some new articles, both down in the Wilmington newspaper and in the what was known as the Raleigh Christian Advocate, in the archives over there at Duke. I spent many days just kind of combing over every issue, and I found out some articles that I believe have never been republished before on their original publication.
Well, I sure wish we had more time to talk about it. What my last question is, have you had enough? Are you tired of Charlie Soong? Have you had enough of him now that you've written the book? Are you moving on to other things? Are you still looking for new information about him?
I would say I'm doing a little bit of both along those lines. I don't think I'll ever tire of the story of Charlie Soong. It's just one of the most fascinating real life stories that I've ever read. I feel like I could read it.
It is a fairy tale in some ways, isn't it? I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up.
Yes, it's a, you know, it's a real rags to riches story. It's a world adventure. It's everything all kind of tied into one. It's got local interest here. It's got international interest.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I still have interest there, but I'm sure I'll be kind of moving on to other topics, but probably somewhat related to Chinese history.
Well, I hope we can talk again either about the new topics or more about Charlie Soong. Thank you so much for the book and for sharing a lot of it with us here on Who's Talking. If you join us late, my guest has been Ed Haig, the author of Charlie Soong, North Carolina's Link to the Fall of the Last Emperor of China. Thanks to him and thanks to you for listening.
Well, thank you, Dean.
I'll be back here before you know it.